In a novel twist on a hackneyed expression, vocalist Martin Fry of ABC sang on their 1982 hit, The Look of Love, "If you judge a book by the cover, then you judge the look by the lover. I hope you'll soon recover." No, me neither. But I suppose it offers an aid memoir reinforced by a catchy tune that one should not judge others by appearances. Gosh, at 15 stones in weight, bearded with long hair, earring and tattoo, and usually clad in leathers or denim, I can tell you all about that one. Yet, behind this dishevelled middle-aged monument to excess, once lay a youthful athlete of some modest ability, and I've dined out on numerous occasions by relating the absolutely true tale of my not-so-grand participation. I completed the course in an unremarkable time and was left shattered for some while afterwards at the 1983 Heart of England Marathon around the delightful little market town of Atherstone, Warwickshire. As we jostled for space, awaiting the starter signal, I glanced at my fellow competitors, a mixed bunch if ever there was. To my right, I saw the scruffiest of urchins in threadbare attire and a battered old pair of what we used to call tennis pumps on his feet. I watched in amazement as he took a black plastic bin liner and ripped three pieces out of it to accommodate his arms and head. Dressing himself thus, he looked, to be frank, quite ridiculous, but remained oblivious to anyone noticing. And to my left, Adidas man. Head-to-toe designer running stuff. I watched in curiosity as he lifted his wrist and adjusted what appeared to be a watch, but from which was emanating a strident beep, beep, beep. "What's that?" I inquired. "Ah," he explained enthusiastically, "set this to what pace you want to run and then just match the beeps to your rhythm. If I set it to around 7 minutes per mile to start off, then pick up the pace towards the end, I should do the course in sub-3 hours. Impressive. There is such a thing as out-psyching your fellows, and if anyone was going to do so, then here he stood. Off we went as we steadied to our own tempos. Nowadays, anyone running around the block seems to be carrying a water bottle, but back in 83, the first hydration station did not appear until 10 miles into the race. The next big hurdle to face is what runners refer to as the wall, a sudden fatigue at around 18 miles when the body has exhausted its supply of glycogen in the liver and muscles. It's a horrible feeling, alleviated greatly by those glucose tablets stashed in the back pocket. Anyway, as I hit my own wall, who should come dashing past me with a cheery hello but bin liner man? I never saw him again. He was gone into the distance. At precisely that point, I recall coming down a long open slope where, about half a mile yonder, I could see blue flashing lights and a horizontal body being lifted onto a stretcher. By the time I'd reached the scene, the patient had been covered in one of those silver space blankets before being taken to hospital, so I could not see who it was. But I could distinctly hear a steady beep, beep, beep going, I would guess, at about 7 minutes a mile. And that, as if anyone needed a lesson, was affirmation of not to judge by appearances. So, let me fast forward almost 4 decades to a recent experience where my disinclination to assess by looks alone was challenged, but I am delighted to relate, was not found wanting. Allow me to paint the scene. For reasons that will become apparent when I describe him, the young man in question is considered vulnerable, so I will do nothing to identify him by name or location or the precise circumstances, but that is all of no relevance to the tale anyway, so here goes. For some considerable time, I have been associated with a facility that caters for those unfortunate who, quite simply, cannot be accommodated within the confines of contemporary mainstream education. There are those who might write them off as beyond meaningful assistance, but this is as erroneous as it is judgmental, and with careful but intensive nurturing, it is astonishing what the human spirit can overcome when played to its strengths rather than disparaged for its weaknesses. A few years back, for example, I was shown two identically shaped glass tumblers by a man supervising a young lad who had been all but abandoned by the conventional establishment and with evident difficulties sitting at a diamond cutting wheel. The one glass was etched carelessly with meaningless scratches. The other was a fine piece of hand-cut crystal that would have graced any shop. The supervisor handed them both to me, incredulous. 6 weeks from one to the other, he said in amazement. Acquiring that level of skill usually takes years. Meanwhile, back to my latest caper and a call I received from another supervisor at the same facility, inviting me to be the subject of a photo shoot for a young photographer wishing to expand his portfolio. I was introduced to a man in his 20s, ascetically thin, maybe standing less than 5.5 feet in his boots, cheek studs, tattoos aplenty, and a Mohican haircut. It transpires that he had half of his innards missing, and is fed on a liquid diet via a tube in his chest. As if that wasn't enough to spoil his day, and please don't even get me started on the existence of a munificent god who sits atop such things, he was on the upper register of the autistic scale. He was one of the most charming and affable young men I have ever met. The problems he had to face just to get through the day are simply unimaginable to the likes of most of us. But then, put a Nikon in his hands, and wow, was he in the zone. A shot here, an instruction there, a direction to change stance or shift position, he was totally gone. He completed a suite of shots, some of which made their way into my inbox shortly afterwards. I immediately took one, blew it up, and sent it to a picture framer for hanging in my office. I told his supervisor what I'd done and was informed he's dancing around the yard outside with joy. Tears rolled down my cheeks for some while afterwards. Yet I go back to the young man who was first presented to me and wonder how many of us would have walked by on the other side. Perhaps, and I'm ashamed to even think so, I could have been one of them. But how, in a supposedly advanced society, do we make such discriminatory initial judgments? And, perhaps more importantly, why? It appears that genetics and heredities may play an equal role to simple prejudice and behavioural patterns. In his scholarly book, Interaction of Colour, first published in the 1960s and still in print, theorist and lecturer Joseph Albers, who described himself as a martyr to modernism, expanded the ways in which colours are used and perceived in art, architecture, textiles, interior designs, graphic media and technology. The book is a standard text for my other half, Mary, herself a recognised authority on the use of colours in map-making, and I would never have imagined that an artistic reference work would have aided me in one of my own existential dilemmas, but hey-ho, life's full of surprises. Here's a brief extract of what Albers proposed. In visual perception, a colour is almost never seen as it really is, as it physically is. In order to use colour effectively, it is necessary to recognise that colour deceives continually. First, it should be learned that one and the same colour evokes innumerable readings. Instead of mechanically applying or merely employing laws and rules of colour harmony, distinct colour effects are produced through recognition of the interaction of colour by making, for instance, two very different colours look alike or nearly alike. And so, I would submit, by extension, does this also apply to physical appearances? That's through a similar recognition of the interaction of colour, although I confess I've yet to comprehend precisely what this interaction is, can render two very different identities look alike or nearly alike. An analysis posted on her online blog by self-styled spiritual pilgrim Beth Bruno of South Carolina, USA, suggests our perceptions of others are definable by categories underpinned by, you're probably ahead of me guessing this one, social media. People are eager to give their opinions about our lives and choices, she claims, and again by extension in my interpretation, appearances too. Sarcastic and rude comments on others' posts seems to bring a sense of satisfaction to our egos, while this may seem innocuous enough, since we can do this with a measure of anonymity, it is far from being harmless to ourselves and others, she concludes. That not only seems reasonable, it also brings nastiness and prejudice squarely into the age of cyberspace. But why are we so quick to judge? According to an article in Psychology Today of May 2018, written by one Elizabeth Dorrance Hall, PhD, our brains are attempting to make sense of why people do the things they do. We make snap judgments about people because it moves us on to the next thing our brains need to work out. In other words, it's the quickest way to answer the question, what the hell, when we see someone do something that makes no sense or evokes a visceral response of anger or aversion. Dr. Hall goes on to suggest that if we checked ourselves throughout the day to see how often we were being judgmental, we might be shocked by the degree of negative judgment on both ourselves and of others. She advises in conclusion, there is a way to flip the habit on its head, and if we are willing to change this paradigm, we might find that the world opens up for us. I fear I may be entering uncharted waters here, so to avoid any pretense of psychospeak, I'll leave the last word to that anonymous young photographer friend to whom I was delighted to offer a bit of empathy and support that took but a few minutes of a day that I might otherwise have squandered anyway. The thoughts of him dancing around the yard outside with joy are still with me. And, I have to say, I feel rather good about myself. Thus, my understanding of the practical consequences of positive changes to that paradigm, which I am happy to confirm, are singularly uplifting.